coming this weekend to downtown Seattle, people dressed like comic book characters. They'll be here by the thousands for SakuraCon, the Pacific Northwest's oldest and biggest convention for fans of all things anime, gaming, and Asian culture. It's happening at the Washington State Convention Center. And for sure, some of those people will say they're more than fans. They're super fans. Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer have spent a lot of time thinking about how a fan levels up to a superfan. They're co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. And they found being a superfan requires more of you than just liking something.
Being a fan is active. It's not a thing that someone is. It's a thing that they do. It's something that they can participate in actively and help to contribute to what makes that thing a better fan object.
We talk about fandom as performative, that you can't be a fan alone or in isolation. If you are a consumer of, say, Harry Potter, you may sit at home and read the books. But to actively be a fan, you need to either go see the Harry Potter theme parks or go talk to other people about Harry Potter and express which house you would get sorted into, or go stand and wait in line for the new release. That's a fan, and it requires being active and actually fanning on behalf of your fan object, as opposed to just being a really enthusiastic consumer who might read all the books and then watch all the movies and take notes for yourself, but not really do that in the company of other people.
It sounds like not every consumer is a fan, that's clear. But can you be a fan without being a consumer? Meaning, can you be a fan without the spending money part of it?
Strangely enough, you actually can. Fans and consumers do often have a lot of overlap, but they don't have to. That's the nice thing about having so many of these different, we call them the fan-like activities, different ways that people can show their love and devotion and their status within a fan community. It's true that maybe forming a collection could require some money, but other things might not. Things like traveling or dressing up as that fan object, if it's a celebrity, things like helping others to find the fandom and answer questions. These are all things that can be done for free. And certainly in many contexts, it would be impossible to be a consumer of that fan object. For example, fans of DeLorean cars, there are only a certain number of them in existence. Most people who are fans of those will maybe even never even see one in person, much less own one.
Well, you've brought up a couple of different examples of kinds of fans, right? Aaron, you talked about Harry Potter fans. We just talked a little bit about DeLorean fans as well, Zoe. But are all fans the same? I guess I'm thinking about what fandom looks like here in Seattle. And we have fans of the Seattle Seahawks, but we also have fans of the Star Wars franchise. So if it's just the actions you're describing that make someone a fan, and if those two groups came together, what they would have to talk about.
Fans, in a way, can actually be thought of as the same. Often when we differentiate in our heads between, say, a sports fan and a comics fan, both of which Seattle has plenty of, we think of them as these two very distinct groups of people. We think sports fan, that's socially acceptable. Being a comics fan, may or may not be. The real difference between groups like that is usually actually external. It's the stigma that people place those groups under. It has much more to do with how people think of those social groups and whether or not they would actually want to be associated with them than anything about the actual thing that they're a fan of. In terms of the activities, both groups actually do very similar things. They both go to conventions, whether that's in an arena or, at a convention center or a hotel. They both dress up in special costumes, whether that's a jersey or dressing up like, Spider-Man. They both collect things, whether it's sports memorabilia or figurines. So we're seeing very, very similar behaviors. It's just that society is okay with one and not so okay with the other sometimes.
I brought up an example of Seattle Seahawks super fans. They dress up in special costumes, as you said. They may have collections. They travel. They do all these other things to support their love of the Seahawks. But did you, in writing this book and doing this research, is there anything unique about the way Seattle does super fandom?
Well, so, I mean, I think super fandom is fairly universal in a sense of how people actually perform it, but there's a lot of things that Seattle have that people become super fans of. And Seattle, and especially giving your location, giving some of the more interesting companies that have been founded there, has a lot of sites where people come and we do pilgrimages to. So one of my favorites is Starbucks and Pike Place Marketplace, because it's actually the foundation of this global enterprise that people love. I mean, people love their pumpkin spice lattes, and they actually will take pilgrimages and write about going to see the original Starbucks, even if it's not the original Starbucks and is the second one. But they make an effort to seek out that location so that they can experience this thing they love in kind of this location that means a lot to them and that they internalize a lot.
That's interesting. So Seattle is unique, you're saying, because it has a lot of, I guess, sacred sites for super fans, like that Starbucks in Pike Place, for example.
Sacred actually is a great way of putting it. Pilgrimage is actually a term that comes from religion. People have been taking pilgrimages for probably as long as there's been culture. So it makes sense that this is something which people feel close to, not necessarily because it's pretty or because it has economic value, but just because of the feeling and the sacredness of what they feel when they go there. And Seattle actually has a number of sites like that.
I mean, one of the things I think interesting about Seattle is a lot when we in the book, we talk about how fandom in a lot of ways is losing its stigma as we get further along in this century, largely because of the rise of the internet and kind of the rise of the tech star. And with Microsoft and all of the large tech industry there, I think Seattle got there a little bit faster than everyone else did. There is a convention in Seattle that was started in 2004 called PAX, which was originally the Penny Arcade Expo, which was, as far as I know at that time, the only gaming expo in the world. You had things like San Diego Comic Con that did comics and pop culture. But the people who founded PAX really wanted something oriented around gaming in itself to celebrate this thing they loved. And gaming still in the early 2000s had a decent amount of stigma around to it. The people who sat at home and played video games and board games kind of were looked at a little bit like the comics fans were, where they were, you know, playing on their Xbox and not really socializing. And this event started with 3,000 people and has since grown to 70,000 and five different conventions that happen around the world every year, all origin in Seattle. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the tech industry reduced a lot of the stigma around those types of things, perhaps in Seattle sooner than elsewhere, and certainly definitely than the middle of the country.
You have both brought up the word stigma when it comes to fandom, that there is still a little stigma associated with being a super fan of different kinds of things. So I'm sure that there is someone listening to this who is thinking, why should I care about fans? Why should I care about super fans? What do you want people who don't have this relationship with a fan object to take away from the benefits, I guess, of fandom?
A lot of the traditional organizing institutions that we used to count on for coming together as groups, things like, the local religion, the local government, immediate family groups, all of these obviously are still important in the modern day, but we're finding that modern people within the last 150 years, say, have started realizing that all of these institutions can be infallible. Our parents aren't always correct about everything. The place that we grew up isn't necessarily the place we want to live the rest of our lives. And as these organizations maybe dim a little bit in importance, we need other things to bring us together as a group. We need other ways to answer these important questions of who am I? Where do I belong in this world? How should I be behaving? How can I meet other people like myself? And thank goodness we have pop culture to fill in some of these questions for us, right? Because no one wants to live a life of existential dread. We're all looking for answers at any given moment. And the nice thing about pieces of pop culture, these things that now we use to make fan groups out of, is they can answer those questions true. It's true that something like the Bible has, you know, examples of how people could act, but so does Harry Potter, and certainly so does something like Star Wars. And for people who are looking for that, that's very important too.
Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer. They're the co-authors of the book Super Fandom: How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are.